Last week I had the opportunity to drive up to Buffalo, and as you know, riding along in a car and you're all alone, your mind wanders all over the place sometimes. It was really cold, and I was thinking about how cold it was and how it was getting warmer a degree or two at a time. But I got to think about, took me 3 hours about drive to Buffalo, and it was in comfort. I had a good heater in the car, and the windows sealed up, and I got thinking about, 100 years ago, to make a trip to Buffalo in an automobile would have taken you a long time, a lot more than a couple, 3 hours, and it wouldn't have been very comfortable. And that kind of led me back in history. And up until probably mid-1800s, high-speed transportation was a horse. People walked, rode a horse or a wagon, or were drawn by an oxen with a cart. Just altogether different. You think back from the time of Adam up until approximately the 1850s, everybody lived the same for the most part. They all lived on a farm or raised their own food. People lived in cities, had food plots outside, or had people raise their food for them if you were really rich. It was just different, and it didn't change until mid-1850s. There are a lot of things that people heated back then with wood or with coal. Wasn't anything else. Wasn't no natural gas, wasn't kerosene, wasn't furnaces that are automatically set. So people really had a lot of different lifestyle. As we look at scriptures, we see that, and we need to keep into perspective what Paul said. In Corinthians, I'm not going to turn there, but Paul talks a lot about prophecy, about faith enough to move mountains, and yet, he said the most important thing is love. So anytime that we look at the scriptures, we need to look and keep in mind that love for one another, for the people of the world, people that aren't called yet by God, is the most important thing. That's what we need to really focus on. And if you want to look that up, that's in 1 Corinthians 13 down through 1 Corinthians 14, probably about verse 12. But we all have a basic body of beliefs. I grew up as a young person in the Tawanda area, and I had a basic set of beliefs, and we all have them. As God begins to work with us and we become interested in the Holy Scriptures, we change quite a lot as we understand more and more about the Scriptures. And sometimes, I know in my life, I started listening to Mr. Armstrong in May about 1960. I was on my way home from California. My wife and I got married out there. We were on our way back. And the more I listened, the more I began to agree with some of the things that he had to say. And as I mixed what he was teaching with what my own basic body of beliefs were, I come up with some really screwball conclusions. I mean, they didn't mix. I mixed them, but I didn't understand. And I was in quite a lot of errors that went along. Like Paul said, you see through, as looking in a mirror darkly or through a glass darkly. We've all experienced coming to grips with things that we thought were correct, and they weren't correct. And it's a struggle, even if we're almost right, to figure out, we got to do this, and we got to give that up. And we've all experienced that in our lives, whether we're in the church or not. knowledge that we formerly thought was true, that really believed it was true, and it wasn't. The scripture says the Holy Spirit leads us into all truth. We, most of us in this room, have had experiences where men were leading us, and they were leading us into new truth. Wasn't new truth. Really was old error, but pretty hard. Some people are pretty good at maneuvering other people. So whenever man comes up with new truth, you need to check it against this. Look in this book and see if it's truth or if it's not. Compare everything to the Word of God. Men can lead us, and we've experienced that also, into hope and truth. But if what he's teaching is not in here, there's not so much hope and not much truth. We have to be very careful to compare any and all ideas, whether other men or our own, to the Holy Scripture. Compare it to the Word of God. Always. Always. Don't skip it on anything. Have you ever had a question that you wrestled with for a long time and might be in the scriptures, but you can't put your finger on an answer? I have one of those. Jesus Christ stated in Matthew 24 and verse 2, when he was talking to the disciples after they'd just come out of the temple and they were looking back and the disciples were talking to him about the temple and everything around it. Jesus Christ said, not one stone shall be left one upon the other. I've had that question beating around in my head for years. You look at the Wailing Wall. Many, many Jews pray at the Wailing Wall on the Temple Mount. A lot of stones, thousands of stones, one upon the other. How can that be? If Jesus Christ said, all these stones are going to be thrown down, not one on top of another. I've talked to some people very recently, and they said, well, Jesus Christ is going to come back, and it's going to be a big earthquake, and then all the stones are going to be down. I don't think so. I don't think that fits in what he was saying. God cannot lie. Jesus Christ is his son. Jesus Christ said, as my Father does, so do I. So if God does not lie, Jesus Christ does not lie. I mean, it just follows. Are we missing something in this scenario? And if we are, what is it? There are a lot of prophecies in the scripture, but the title of my message today, I'm picking one, and we're not going to cover it in depth. We're going to get back to it after a while, but was Micah a false prophet? Was Micah a false prophet? My specific purpose today is to show that some things that we know or think we know may not be as they appear, or definitely not as most people understand them to be. It's a little different format from what I usually talk on, but there's a plot of ground in Israel, and it's called the most contested plot of ground in the world. Three major religious faiths focus on that area. Holy wars have been fought, and there are prophecies in the scriptures of more wars being fought over this one piece of ground. That piece of ground is the Jerusalem Temple Mount. What if? That's a what if question. What if history has it wrong? What if? the spot of Solomon's temple and later Herod's temple was not upon the Temple Mount. What if it was 600 feet away and lower? There's a new book out. It's written by a gentleman by the name of Robert Cornuke, C-O-R-N-U-K-E. It's entitled Temple, Amazing New Discoveries That Change Everything About the Location of Solomon's Temple. I just bumped into this on the internet a couple weeks ago. I jumped on the phone and ordered one. They said they didn't have it in 3 days. And 2 days later, I got an email back from, oops, we don't have any anymore. We can get the copies for you in about 10 to 12 days or something like that. Do you want to change your shipping? Because I wanted to ship high-speed shipping, a couple of days of shipping. So it didn't come. And still hasn't come, so I'm expecting it. I'm really looking forward to looking at that book. This book is turning heads in scholarly circles all over the place to suggest that the traditional Temple Mount, where Jews have prayed to the Wailing Wall and Muslims pray up at the Dome of the Rock, is actually not holy ground, is sacrilege to many historians and archaeologists, not to mention clerics. If true, it means the unthinkable for the Muslims and opens new possibilities for the Jews. It's kind of like they described it when I saw it on the internet. I think it was World News Daily or World Net Daily, where it was advertised. It's kind of like kryptonite. You know, Superman, everybody knows Superman. We grew up with Superman. But if you had a little piece of kryptonite, it took Superman's strength and power all away from him, made him just as weak as any other normal man. They claim that this understanding is the kryptonite of biblical archaeology. Mr. Cornreich said it's not his brainchild. He is following up on a book by Dr. Ernest Martin. And the book that Mr. Martin wrote was The Temples That Jerusalem Forgot. It was published in the year 2000. I hadn't heard about it. When I didn't get my other book, I called the number they had for this book, and I got a hold of Mr. Martin's widow. He died in 2003, I think. I talked to her. I don't know how many of you people remember Dr. Ernest Martin, the name at all. He was a part of Ambassador College way back in the 60s. I don't know whether he was going there, but I remember the name from way back. I didn't know wherever he went, but I've got something I want to read that shows a little bit of where he was. But as I talked to her, I ordered the book, and I mentioned that I'd been a part of Worldwide Church of God from in the early 60s up through 95 area. And she volunteered something I thought was really interesting. She said that Dr. Martin was really appreciative of the fact that he had an opportunity to attend God's holy days through the cycle a number of times, because when he wrote about it, he had a better understanding of it. And it just came out of the blue because I had mentioned that I had been a part of the Worldwide Church of God for that period of time. Let's see where I am. But I haven't gotten that book either, so it, I did get a video from them as a free gift, and that came Saturday, and it was pretty interesting. Quoting Mr. Cornreich, this site, the Jerusalem Temple Mount, has been misdiagnosed and accepted for so long that none has ever dared to challenge it. This book has only been out a little over 6 months, crowding towards a year. But it's already starting to upset the apple cart. He tells about receiving many, many phone calls and emails from scholars and from other people. But to date, no one, of all the communication he's got, no one has said, "You are wrong. And here's the reason why." Nobody. Nobody said that. So let's look at some of his proofs that he puts in his book and answer the question. If the Western Wall is not the ruins of the temple, what is it? If it's not the ruins of the temple, what is it? A little bit about Mr. Cartwright. He was a police officer in California for about 10 years. He was an FBI-trained investigator, a member of the SWAT team. As he neared his end point of 10 years in the police force, he and some others were involved in a 3-hour gun battle with somebody that was holed up with 700 rounds of ammunition. And it caused him to rethink his career choices. And he left the police force, went back to college, went to Louisville Baptist Seminary, and Louisville Baptist University. And he's now the president of Biblical Archaeological Search and Exploration Institute. He's been featured on ABC, Fox News, CNN, National Geographic, and the History Channel. I'll touch on the story flow of the book. He starts out with the building of the Dome of the Rock. Abib al-Malik, an Arab caliph, built the Dome of the Rock in 691 AD. It was built where it is, mainly because it overlooks and overshadows or looks down on the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where it is believed that Jesus rose from the dead, and they built a church over that site. Muslims believe that their religion is the perfection of Judaism. The Dome of the Rock was built bigger and above the area where Christ was resurrected, mainly, and he meant it to be, a statement to Christians who were the dominant religion in that area before it was conquered by the Muslims. So we're better than you. We're going to look down on you. So they built it up there. Matthew 24, verses 1 and 2, Christ said, "Not one stone will be left upon another." The Western Wall has thousands of stones. The Jews believe that it's a part of the temple, and therefore a holy place. Historical accounts say the Romans so fully destroyed the temple in 70 through 73 AD during the wars that it became nothing but a field of weeds. Josephus, in his book, series of books actually on Jewish wars, wrote that the site, the Temple Mount, was actually Fort Antonio, home of the Roman 10th Legion. They had 6,000 troops up there. They had 4,000 support personnel. So they had 10,000 people housed and armed and everything up on, really, on the Temple Mount. It's approximately 36 acres up there on the flats, and they need about that much for 10,000 troops and horses and whatever else they had. Josephus wrote that the fort, Fort Antonio, was much bigger than the temple. Josephus' works, his writings, are considered highly credible on every other topic. But for some reason, his description of the temple, location, and size, everything is denigrated and dismissed by modern historians. So Josephus wrote about it, and he said it's this way. And they said, no, it can't be that way. Scholars say the temple area was much larger than the fort. Scholars claim Josephus exaggerated, therefore he lied, and it's not true. But everything else Josephus wrote, they consider very, very credible. In 1973, a famous historian, Michael Avnona, made a model that he considered to be the first century Jerusalem. He made a scale model of it. And Fort Antonio was a small appendage to the temple up on the northwest corner. It fits nicely with tradition, but Conrack says it ignores eyewitness accounts of what really was going on in Jerusalem at the time. Main problem with the fort is way too small to house 6,000 people, much less 10,000 people. Another piece of the puzzle, apparently a translator of Josephus' works back about that time mistranslated a word. The word was tagma, T-A-G-M-A, and this means a legion or 6,000 to 10,000 people. It was translated as a cohort, C-O-H-O-R-T, which is a much smaller unit of the Roman military. It was 480 men. Every other time that Josephus uses the word tagma, he uses it to describe such much, much larger numbers of soldiers, such as the 5th Legion, the 10th Legion, the 12th, and the 15th. The 10th Legion is the one that was stationed at Rome. A small unit called a cohort is about 480 soldiers, and it fits well with a small Roman fort like is portrayed in the 1973 model. Question. Would 480 men be sufficient to maintain order in a province that's populated by 175,000 people and would swell to about 300,000 during the holy days? And these people, Jews, were prone to riot. Are 480 people going to control 100 or 200,000 just average time? I don't think so. In Acts, we'll look at that a little more completely in a minute, but Paul was arrested and escorted by 470 men. It talks about 470 men out of the total of 480 to protect a single prisoner bound in chains heading up to Caesarea. And out of the 480, they left 10. Doesn't make any sense with 10 people to defend and control Jerusalem. Here's testimony from another eyewitness. Now, suppose, go back a second, that 480 or 470 out of 6,000 to take Paul up to Caesarea would be about 8%. So they'd have 92% of the troops left to maintain order. Testimony of another eyewitness, Eleazar ben Jari. He was the commander of the Jewish rebels at Masada. In his description of the destruction of Jerusalem, quote, yeah, Jerusalem, is now demolished to the very foundations, and nothing left but that monument of it preserved, I mean the camp of those, the Romans, that have destroyed it, which still dwells upon its ruins. There wasn't anything left. They put it to the ground. He said the temple is gone, even the foundations uprooted, fulfilling Christ's prophecy. I ran into something maybe a year and a half ago, that the main reason that the Roman soldiers tore the temple completely down, left no stone unturned because of the gold that was in the temple. Everything was gold. The doorposts were covered with gold. There was just gold everywhere. And they burned the temple, and gold liquefies at a very, very low temperature. And it ran down the cracks and went down around under the stones. It was everywhere, but little bits and pieces, little stream or something. And they tore it apart to get the gold. And that really made sense to me. Let's look for a minute at Micah, chapter 3. Micah, chapter 3, and we'll read it starting verse 8. Micah, chapter 3, and verse 8. Micah speaking, but truly I am full of the power of the Spirit of the Lord, and of judgment, and of might, to declare unto Jacob his transgression, and unto Israel his sin. Hear this, I pray you, you heads of the house of Jacob, and you princes of the house of Israel, that abhor judgment, and pervert all equity. They build up Zion with blood, and Jerusalem with iniquity. The heads thereof judge for reward, and the priests thereof teach for hire, and the prophets thereof divine for money. Yet will they lean upon the Lord and say, is not the Lord among us? Is not the Lord among us? None evil can come upon us. Micah goes on, verse 12, therefore shall Zion for your sake be plowed as a field, and Jerusalem shall become heaps, and the mountain of the house as the high places of the forest. So Micah prophesied that Jerusalem was going to be level, right to the bottom. If it didn't happen, that kind of leads you to believe, well, maybe Micah was a false prophet. But we know that's not true, not even possible. Because that would also mean Jesus Christ would be a false prophet, because he said all the stones are coming down. Let's look at some of the history about the building of the temple. Let's start in 2 Chronicles chapter 3. 2 Chronicles chapter 3. I should have marked that one. 2 Chronicles chapter 3, and we'll begin reading right in verse 1. Nope, that can't be right. I meant 1 Chronicles. No wonder it didn't look right. You got to get in the right page. 2 Chronicles chapter 3. And Solomon began to build the house of the Lord at Jerusalem in Mount Moriah, where the Lord appeared unto David his father, in the place that David had prepared in the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. And it goes on to tell they began to build on the second day of the second month. Ornan the Jebusite, and another, I think this is in 1 Chronicles 21. Let's look at that. 1 Chronicles 21. 1 Chronicles 21, beginning in verse 15. And God sent an angel unto Jerusalem to destroy it. And as he, the angel, was destroying it, the Lord beheld And he repented him of the evil, and he said to the angel that destroyed, "It's enough. Stay now your hand." And the angel of the Lord stood by the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. Verse 16, and David lifted up his eyes, and he saw the angel of the Lord stand between the earth and the heaven, having a drawn sword in his hand, stretched out over Jerusalem. Then David and the elders of Israel, who were clothed in sackcloth, fell upon their faces. And David said unto God, "Is it not I that commanded the people to be numbered? Even I it is that have sinned and done evil indeed. But for these poor sheep, what have they done? What have they done? Let your hand, I pray you, O Lord, my God, be upon me and my father's house, but not on the people, that they should be plagued." Verse 18, the angel of the Lord commanded Gad to say to David that David should go up and set up an altar unto the Lord in the thrashing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. So this was a pretty important place way back before they built a temple in. David went up at the saying of Gad, which he spoke in the name of the Lord, and Ornan turned back and saw the angel, and his four sons were with him, hid themselves. Now, Ornan was thrashing wheat. Verse 21, and as David came to Ornan, Ornan looked and saw David and went out of the thrashing floor and bowed himself to David with his face to the ground. And David said to Ornan, "Grant me this place of this thrashing floor, that I may build an altar herein unto the Lord, and that you will grant it to me for the full price, that the plague may be stayed from off the people." And Ornan said unto David, "Take it to you, and let my lord the king do what is good in his eyes. Lo, I give you the oxen and the burnt offering, the threshing instruments for wood, and the wheat for the meat offering. I will give it all." David the king said to Ornan, "No, but I will verily buy it for the full price. I will not take that which is yours for the Lord, nor offer burnt offering without cost." So David gave to Ornan for the place 600 shekels of gold by weight. And David built there an altar unto the Lord and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings and called upon the Lord. And he, the Lord, answered him from heaven by fire upon the altar of the burnt offering. And the Lord commanded the angel, and he put up his sword again into the sheath thereof. At that time, David saw that the Lord had answered him in the thrashing floor of Ornan the Jebusite, and then he sacrificed there. David's reign begins back in 2 Samuel chapter 5. Some of this is scattered all over, but it takes a little chasing. 2 Samuel chapter 5, and we'll pick up reading in verse 4. David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned for 40 years. And in Hebron he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem he reigned 33 years over Israel and Judah. So he started out his reign in Hebron. But he came to Jerusalem, and it was called the Jebus, J-E-B-U-S, was the name of the town and city at that time. And that's why the Jebusites lived there. They were the people of Jebus. David, being a military man, knew that this was a really, really good place to have a capital city. Had water. Water ran right there out of the side of the mountain. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit. But he bought the city, or bought the threshing floor, and set it up. And then he planned for the temple to be built there, and Solomon built the temple at that threshing floor site. But it was pretty easily protected. There were regular mountains around, ridges that you couldn't get at that city. And I think I have it down here. But the people of the city told David, they were taunting him. They said, the blind and the lame can defend this city. You cannot come here. And I think that's in, is it in this 4 through 10? Yeah, I guess. Let's read on down. And the king and his men went to Jerusalem unto the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, which spoke unto David, saying, except you take away the blind and the lame, you shall not come in. Thinking, David can't get in here. He cannot take the city. It's so well defended. They had water. They could stay in there for a long, long time. The water ran in and out of the city. Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion. The same is the city of David. We call it the city of David to this day. And Joab in 1 Chronicles 4 tells how Joab took the city. David told him, said, if anybody can get in there and take the city, he said, I'll give them half of the city or a really big reward. And Joab took some of the skilled fighters with him, and there was a drain kind of thing. They call it a gutter. And they climbed up through this tunnel when the water wasn't running down and took the city from the inside. I thought that was pretty interesting. But this hill right today is located within the city of David, the old, they call it the City of David Jerusalem Walls National Park. There's a park there that has this stone in it. In Acts 21, verses 27 to 32, Acts 27. Acts 21, verse 27. I meant 27, 21. I'm all mixed up this morning. Let's back up a little bit. Verse 25. As touching the Gentiles which believe, we have written and concluded that they observe no such thing, save only that they keep themselves the things offered idols and keep from blood and from things strangled and from fornication. Verse 26, and Paul took the men and the next day purified himself with them around and with them entered into the temple to signify the accomplishment of the days of purification until that an offering should be offered for every one of them. So he had gone through the Jewish rituals because they were claiming he wasn't a Jew. He bringing Gentiles in. Verse 27, when the 7 days were almost ended, the Jews, which were of Asia, when they saw him in the temple, stirred up all the people. And they laid hands on him, on Paul, crying out, men of Israel, help! This is a man that teaches all men everywhere against the people and the law. And this place, and further brought Greeks into the temple, and has polluted this holy place. And in parentheses, verse 29, it says, for they had seen before with him in that day Trophimus and Ephesian, whom they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple. Verse 30, and all the city was moved, and the people ran together. And they took Paul, and they drew him out of the temple, and forthwith the doors were shut. So they grabbed Paul, jerked him out of the temple, shut the doors. Couldn't go back in. And as they were about to kill him, tidings came unto the chief captains of the band that all Jerusalem was in an uproar. Verse 32, who immediately took soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. And when they saw the chief captain, the soldiers, they left off beating Paul. So Paul was about to be killed, beaten to death. And all of a sudden, Roman soldiers show up. It's interesting, if they only had 480 troops there, it says the chief captain took soldiers and centurions. And we know from a long time back that centurions are commanders of 100 troops. So did he empty everything out and everybody come down? I don't think so. But there were a lot of troops. So the commanders immediately took the soldiers and centurions and ran down to the temple, or toward the temple. Going on in Acts, forgot where I was here. They ran down. When they saw the chief captain and soldiers, they left beating of Paul. When the chief captain came near and took him and commanded him to be bound with two chains and demanded who he was and what he had done. Verse 34, and some cried one thing, some another among the multitude. And when he could not know for certainty for the tumult, he commanded him to be carried into the castle. Not in the temple. He was thrown out of the temple and the doors were shut. So they were taking him somewhere else. And when he came upon the stairs, so it was that he was borne on the soldiers for the violence of the people. So there were stairs by the temple going up to a castle. It goes on to say, the multitude of the people followed after, crying, "Away with him." And as Paul was to be led into the castle, he said to the chief captain, "May I speak to you?" Who said, "Can you speak Greek? Are you not that Egyptian which before these days made an uproar and led out into the wilderness 4,000 men that were murderers? You're a bad dude. You got 4,000 men following you that were murderers." Verse 39, Paul said, "I am a man which am a Jew, of Tarsus, a city in Cilicia, a citizen of no mean city. I beseech you, suffer me to speak to the people." And when he had given him license, Paul stood on the stairs and beckoned with his hand to the people. And when there was a great silence, he spoke to them in the Hebrew tongue, saying, he made his defense, the whole lot of the chapter 22 of it. Acts, Paul's defense. Verse 2, and when they heard that he spoke in the Hebrew tongue to them, they kept the more silent. And he goes on with his defense. Now, the Roman soldiers ran down to the temple. If the temple was on the top, where they called Temple Mount today, there is no place to be down, to come down to there. It's the top. There's nothing higher than that. They couldn't come down out of the sky. They came down stair steps from what is, we understand to be the Temple Mount. They came down stairs to the front of the temple, which was lower than the top of the Temple Mount. Makes a puzzle. And the only possible answer is unless the Temple Mount was actually Fort Antonio and the true temple site was below it in the city of David, it couldn't happen. It couldn't come down from anywhere. They had to come down from Fort Antonio, which is top of the Temple Mount, Dome of the Rock area, down to the temple. The Dead Sea Scrolls, quoting from some Dead Sea Scrolls, "You shall make a channel all around the laver within the building. The channel runs from from the building of the ladder to a shaft and goes down and disappears in the middle of the earth. Likewise, there's a description by Tacitus, T-A-C-I-T-U-S, as a Roman historian. He likewise recorded that the temple had a natural spring of water that welled up from its interior. Every Jewish writing of the time describes a lot of water they had to use to wash away the blood and clean the offering and all that. They had to have running water. The Temple Mount up on the top is a quarter mile away. They've got no running water. And it's higher than this spring. There was a fella on the video clip that I got talking about the temple, and he was an expert in water, and he studied the spring at Gihon, the Gihon spring, and he said it's a siphon spring, and there's only 12 about in the world, and Jerusalem has one. Now, most of us have siphoned gas or water or whatever, but a siphon, the way a siphon spring is built, you have a cavern up in a mountain at a higher elevation that guess where it is. There's no way of knowing for sure. But water runs into this, it's like a bowl, and it runs in and it fills this bowl. When the bowl gets to a certain point, there's an outlet to the cavern, but it goes up and over, like you're siphoning your gas, you start it and you put this down. As long as this end of the hose is in the liquid or the gas, it'll siphon up and go down until this, you either pick this up higher than that so it quits siphoning. But that's the way the water works at this Gihon spring. It fills up, it starts over the top, and siphons down. And it either has to run the cavity clear dry and get water or air into the water from there and break the siphon. And if it does that, then it just goes back to a trickle until the cavern fills up again. Or it can run down and get air to come back up from the bottom, which if you've got a lot of water running, air won't go back up. But I thought that was pretty interesting. Only 1 in 12. And they went through a whole lot of explanation of how the water comes up through the tunnel or shaft to bring it up into the temple. Mr. Cornite says that this archaeological blunder, he says, the biggest blunder in archaeological history, and no one has ever challenged it. Archaeology, he says, is not a science, but it's an art. There are many factors to come into a decision or a conclusion. You take them all into effect, into account, lay them out, think about them. And still, when you get done, the conclusion that you have is your best guess. Because that's thousands of years ago. One of the things that came out in my study of this was when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem, and most of the Jews that were left ran up to the temple or the mountain at Masada, holed up there for a couple, 3 years, I think. They were the last ones, Jewish people, left. Romans didn't allow Jews back in there. They just kept them out of there because they were constant trouble. So there was no one with first-hand information for several hundred years to write down, to remember what it was. And when they started coming back, there was this big wall, and they assumed that it was a temple wall. Josephus writes that there was where the Temple Mount, so-called where it is now, that there was a wall there a stone wall that was like 40-some feet high. Huge. You can't find it. It wasn't there. The guy that was doing this video, there's a like a tunnel, a pathway behind the western wall. It's almost like an alley. And they're videoing, they're walking down there talking about this. You get down to the end, and here's this big rock wall that kind of comes together, and you can't go any farther. And this is that 40-foot wall, they suppose. They said, we think this is that 40-foot wall that Josephus was talking about. Behind the western wall that makes the tunnel, there was walls with big blocks also, but they're set back. Like each big block is set back a half an inch, and the next one's a half an inch, and the next one. So that wall is cantilevered away from the Wailing Wall, the western wall. And they speculate that that is filled with dirt. The whole mountaintop up there was filled. And that's why the stones had to be set back, because the dirt was behind them. And if you're filling, you want the wall to lean into the dirt fill. The interesting thing is the tip of this big rock formation sticks up out of the ground just a little bit. And that's what the temple, Dome of the Rock, is built over. The point of this great big rock is still sticking up out of the fill. Josephus said that the fortress overlooked the temple. It can't happen. If the temple is built on top of the Temple Mount, as they call it today, there's nothing higher than that you could build a fort on and look down. If the original temple was down in the city of David, it built up on top of the mountain, built a tower up, and then one southwestern tower was supposed to be like 50 or 60 feet taller than the rest of the tower. If you stood in that tower, you'd look right down in the temple courtyard. So they knew what the Jewish people were up to. This Mr. Cornreich traveled around and talked quite a lot to different people. Some of the experiences he had, he was talking to people at the Wailing Wall. And he said, virtually universally, everyone that was over 40 years old had the same response. All my life, my grandfather brought me to this wall, my father brought me to this wall, I've come to this wall and prayed to God. Your Jesus is wrong. This is our temple. That's what they told him. Your Jesus is wrong. This is our temple. People that were under 40 were much more receptive to what he was explaining. And some of them said, oh, this is great. Now we can build a temple. We don't have to go up to the Dome of the Rock and fight with the Muslims and the secular Jewish leaders and get a temple built. He was speaking to one of those individuals about that age at the Wailing Wall, and the young man's father came over and grabbed him by the sleeve and said, come away from him. Don't talk to that Gentile anymore. So the fathers were not interested whatsoever. They had a meeting up in New Hampshire with an entire Jewish community got them gathered together, and he was going to come and talk to them about his book. He walks out on stage, and a mother and a father and a son and a daughter got up and walked out before he ever said a word. Obviously, they were making a statement that we don't want to hear you, and this is our opinion, and we're stuck with it, I guess. The rest of the people that stayed for the meeting were pretty excited, talked about it quite a bit after the meeting. But he goes on to say, there comes a time when you have to force feed your mind past reason and logic to accept some of these things that tradition teaches. And tradition teaches that the top of the Wailing Wall is where the temple is. it's kind of like, you know, there are people that still believe the earth is flat. There's a flat earth society. And it's still going on. I didn't check it until this morning, but they're still out there. They still believe the earth is flat. Part of the thing that was on the website about it, the people who believe the flat earth society think that Antarctica and Arctic ice is a wall that forms the sides of a bowl that keeps the water from running off the face of the earth. I mean, you have to, as he puts it, there comes a time when you have to force feed your mind past reason and logic. And that's what they're doing. They're force feeding their mind past reason and logic to believe that the earth is flat. Crazy. Why don't scholars push this type of research? Scholars like to stay in the safe zone. They get paid. They are teachers of the teachers. They protect their jobs. If they go off and bring up something like this, it's controversial. They get hammered. And it's a lose-lose for them. If they're getting hammered for this controversial thing, they're not going to get an advancement in their job. They're not going to get a better job. They're not going to get funding to research whatever they're doing. They really don't like controversy. But God reveals things in His time, in His way, and for His glory. Some of the history on this line of thinking started back with Dr. Ernest Martin. I'm going to read a promotion thing for his book that I snagged down off the internet. I have to get my glasses on, smaller print, but he starts out, "In this large world in which we live, no man is ever an island. Each of us is constantly coming in contact with others from whom we can learn many valuable teachings that cause us to change our minds on some important occasions. In regard to the discovery of the site of the temples in Jerusalem, I've had the pleasure and the good fortune of being brought into the company of many top historians and archaeologists from Jerusalem over the period of my professional career as a historian and theologian. My first visit to Jerusalem in 1961 set my mind on solving the problems that affected the geographical comprehension of early Jerusalem throughout its periods in history." I think, I hadn't checked that, but I'm quite sure that he was a part of the Ambassador College team that went over 1961 to participate in the dig. "I watched closely how Professor Benjamin Lazar and Ben Dove, his assistant at the time, went about their professional duties. And this was a great learning experience. Both of them were more than willing to answer questions for me in the private times that I could learn from them." And I remember Mr. Armstrong talking about and meeting with and Mr. Benjamin Lazar, Professor Lazar, when they were working on the dig over their archaeological excavation. I later met Professor Mazar's son, Ori, who was the first to recommend to me that the temples of Solomon and Zerubbabel were located on the Orphal Mound just to the north of the original Mount Zion in the southeast ridge. He said that his father was leaning in that direction at the time of his death. After a study of 6 months in 1995, I wrote a preliminary report that suggested strongly that this theory was indeed correct for the two earlier temples. I was then under the impression that Simon the Hasmonean, along with Herod a century later, moved the temple from the Orphal Mound to the Dome of the Rock area. Mr. Bill Labors in England, in closely reading the text of Josephus, mentioned that Herod had stated dogmatically that his temple, though enlarged to be double in the size of the former temple, was still located in the same general area as that of the former temples. This also was pointed out by Dr. James Tabor and David Seeloff, my historian and compositional editor. When I noticed the eyewitnesses accounts of Eleazar, who led the final contingent of Jewish resistance to the Romans at Masada, he stated that the Roman fortress, which had been long been in Jerusalem, was the only structure left by 73 current era. With this key in mind, I came to the conclusion in 1997 that all the temples were indeed located on the Orphel Mound over the area of the Gihon Spring. It then became clear that the dimensions of the temple, with its unique shape and characteristics, was not the Haram al-Sha'if. This book is a result of my concluding research that shows the temples of God in Jerusalem were indeed located over the Gihon Spring and not over the Dome of the Rock. What has been amazing to me is the vast amount of Jewish, Muslim, and Christian records that remain available from the 1st to the 16th century that clearly vindicate the conclusions that I've reached in this book of research. Any information that you readers may have or discover that either support or detract from the conclusions that I've made in this book would be greatly appreciated by me. That's unusual for a writer of a book to welcome comment and criticism, whatever else. A couple of selected reviews. This is a review by Dr. Michael Germano, editor of bibarc.com. Professor Emeritus from Ambassador College, graduate of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, who holds earned doctorates from the University of Southern California and the University of Laverne. He has completed postgraduate study in anthropology, archaeology, and theology in Southern Methodist University and Texas A&M at College Station, Texas, and you can contact him, and he gives his phone number and email address and a bunch of stuff. But what he commented, this is an unexpected, exceptional analysis of the history and archaeological data of the temples of Jerusalem. This new explanation of the venue of the first and second temples provides a solution to heretofore incongruous statements in Josephus with the evidence of the biblical and archaeological records. Not only a work of significant scholarly impact, it may well serve as the awaited stimulus for the building of the Jerusalem's third temple by shifting our collective focus from the Haram al-Sharif to the area of the Gihon Spring. Another review, quote, when I first read of Dr. Ernest Martin's thesis that the Jewish temples, those of Solomon and Herod, were located south of the previously accepted Dome of the Rock location, down in the area of the ancient city of David, over the Orphel Spring, my reaction was short and to the point. Impossible. Preposterous. Having now read his arguments, I am convinced that this thesis, however revolutionary and outlandish it first appears, deserves careful academic and critical consideration and evaluation. I'm not yet convinced that Martin has ironed out all of the problems or handled all of the potential objections, yet he has set forth a case that should be heard. His arguments regarding the size of the Fortress Antonio, based on Josephus and other evidence we have about Roman military encampments, must be addressed. He also makes a compelling argument based on Luke, writing a decade or so after the current era, 70 current era destruction, and obviously wanting to report on the lips of Jesus an accurate prediction of the state of things, not one stone left upon another. My initial reading of Martin's presentation has left me with the same impression. All of this evidence needs to be reexamined in the light of this radical proposal. Martin's thesis is so bold, so utterly non-conventional, and so potentially upsetting, radically altering certain aspects of the theological, historical, cultural, and political understanding of Jerusalem and its holy places. It should not be ignored. I hope Martin's book will begin a most interesting debate and critical discussion of relevant issues. That's from Professor James D. Tabor, Director of Religious Studies, University of North Carolina, Charlotte. There are a lot of people talking about this, and this was before Cornreich's book that he just wrote. I think it was published a year ago. But Martin's was published in 2000, and it's just beginning to catch traction. Why should all of this or any of this matter to us? Does it make any difference? For me, I've got to say it answered my question. Why are not Jesus Christ said not one stone left upon another? He was telling the truth, and now it makes sense to me because the Western Wall that they're praying at is from a Roman fortification, the Fort of Antonia. It's the foundational wall of a fort. It's not the foundational wall of a temple. Changes a lot of things. In the end times, scriptures talk about the evening and the morning sacrifice being done away with. We don't see evening and morning sacrifices now. They have to start before they can be ended. We're rapidly, in my opinion, approaching end times. We're in probably, at least in my opinion, beginning of sorrows at a minimum. But the evening and morning sacrifice have to be started and in Jerusalem and probably where the old temple was. Couldn't happen before. Jewish people have petitioned the civil government over there for several years that I know of for permission to go up and sacrifice on the Temple Mount, what they think is the Temple Mount, on Passover. And they get turned down and they get turned down and they get turned down. Maybe it's because God doesn't want them to sacrifice in the wrong place. So it hasn't been available to them. Now, once they accept it, which is, you know, a question, when you think about the Flat Earth Society and how long they've been, you know, they thought the Greek philosophers, I think, were the first to teach that. It was about 300 years before Christ was born. They taught the earth was round. And it's been 2,000, whatever, you know, going on 2,500 years, and there's still some people that believe the earth is flat. I hope it doesn't take that long for the Jews to realize they can set up an altar. They don't have to have a temple, and Ezekiel shows clearly that sacrifices were offered before the temple was built. So they don't have to have a temple to build or to go ahead and offer sacrifices. If this thing is accepted, it would remove Muslim control over Jewish worship. Because they tell them when they can go up on the Dome of the Rock area and when they can't. They have total control of that area. It would allow the Jews to build a temple on the land that they control now, so it could happen anytime. It's really a game changer as far as prophecy being fulfilled in the Middle East. We've seen today a thesis and some of the supporting points that demonstrate that some things are not as we have always believed. It definitely will be interesting to see how all this works out.